Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, I'm Sean Panda-Nicholson from The Isle of Skye, and you're listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything. My question is, would you find it harder to live without your hearing or your sight? Okay, here comes the show, and remember, question everything.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast where myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor, Dane Baptiste, my producer friend, Howard Cohen, a.k.a. The Hizzer.
Hello.
And a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked. And we are talking everything from...
Everything from Sean from Isle of Skye's question, would you find it easier to live without your hearing or your eyesight? Dane, where do you stand on that one?
Oh, the old sensory, question.
Tough one.
I think if I had to choose, I would probably prefer to have my eyesight.
Right. Because?
Well, I feel like if someone says to me, there's an Isle of Skye, I'm like, I want to see that shit. So as opposed to, I want to hear that shit.
I'm definitely going to go for hearing on the basis that I have seen all the people I love in my life, so I can remember what they look like. And I think I could live my life through audiobooks and podcasts as opposed to films. Like, I need the music. I reckon I need the music. I don't think I'd go without it.
So. I get that. It is a tough one, though, because but then you think about it. The disadvantage is that you hear people fart real well, but you'll never be able to find the culprit. Whereas I can smell and see the guilt. That's all I'm saying, Howard. But the most important thing is, do you know what that was? That was like, do you get what that was, Howard? That was like a Richard Pryor, Gene Wilder.
It's our dream. It's our dream come true.
There you go. It's the black Jewish sensory deprivation conundrum, and we love it.
We get that all the time. Suffice to say, Dane, we ask all the questions.
We do ask all the questions, and if you enjoy the show and enjoy us answering the questions, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify. You'll never miss an episode, or subscribe to us on Acast, which is the world's largest podcast network. Speaking of large, another person large in charge is today's esteemed guest. He is legendary, and we don't use the word legendary lightly on this show. You guys know that, you're a bunch of legends.
Very rarely we say legendary.
Very rarely. It's in only the most legendary of instances where you hear us even say legend in a legendary fashion. That being said, today's show is also legendary. We have a British writer and broadcaster who's well known for his very iconic comedy shows, Fist of Fun, and This Morning with Richard, Not Judy. Over 25 years, he has performed 13 hugely successful and critically acclaimed one-man shows at various festivals throughout the world, and he is considered a true pioneer of comedy podcasting with his Leicester Square Theatre podcast, which I've been on. It's very, very good. If you don't know by now, now you're going to know. It's the amazing Richard Herring.
Hello.
Hello, buddy. Bro, how are you?
Kind. I'm very good. That was a very nice introduction. Thank you. You're a very sweet young man.
Richard, what would you choose? Hearing?
Would you choose...
thank you. Would you choose hearing or eyesight, Richard? What do you reckon?
I would keep eyesight, I think. Because you can just have subtitles. I mean, it would be difficult for podcasting if you couldn't hear anything, but you could learn to lip read, right?
Yeah, it's true.
So you could... Yeah. And you could... I think if you... I want to see stuff. I've talked about this a lot on my podcast, so this is going to annoy some people who listen to my podcast, but I have no mind's eye. I'm blind in my mind's eye. I can't visualize stuff in my brain, so that's absolutely true. And so I can't, if you close your eyes, you can probably visualize what you want to think. If you think of an apple, you can close your eyes and visualize it. I can't see anything if I do that.
That's good. There's still an advantage to that, Richard. Like, you know, in the film It, when it's like, I will manifest as your worst fear, and you're like,
okay. Yeah, so I would like to be able, if I can't see, I won't even be able to see in my eyes or my mind's eye, and that would be awful. So I'll take away the hearing, even though I'm probably losing my hearing more than my eyesight, but they're both going a little bit, so there you go. We might find
out. Right. That'll be a nice balance. But I think especially, Howard, maybe you've not taken into account fatherhood, because you know,
yes,
you'd rather be able to see something before you hear it. You'd rather be like, don't touch that, instead of hear So yeah, I think where paternity is concerned, maybe vision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting point. I just don't, honestly, I one of the things about having a baby, I've got a baby, Richard.
Yeah. Oh,
blimey.
Well done.
And thanks. Yeah, it feels like an achievement. I'm, well, yeah. But it loves music. He loves music. And
I don't know if that's the correct non-binary pronoun to use. You can go for they, the or they. Say. Yeah.
Dylan likes music, which is a very enjoyable thing because you're like, it's like experimenting. I put a different thing on and he responds. It's quite enjoyable. Big Neil Diamond fan already, which is interesting. It's got some tunes. So,
If you were deaf, you wouldn't be able to hear your kid crying, which would be quite good. So maybe I'll change it to deaf until they turn 4 or 5. I've got a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old.
Because you can still smell the poo, and you can still feel the cold. You can still look at the stupid pictures from school. Like, this is wonderful. Talk me through it. Knowing full well you can't hear that shit. You're like, oh, well done, son. How did you make this? Well, Dad, I started with some dry macaroni. You're like, yeah, probably. Mm-hmm. Can't hear. That's how I do it.
I suppose the thing about hearing and seeing news would be interesting, wouldn't it? Because you wouldn't, you could be very selective. You couldn't look at Twitter. That would be a positive, wouldn't it? In some ways, I suppose.
That's true. Although you can do voice notes. You can do voice notes on Twitter now. And can you imagine audio only Twitter? Basically, for me, audio only Twitter is kind of like, do you know that first part when Andy Dufresne first gets to prison in A Shawshank Redemption? And they're like, hey, boy, I'm going to tell you a new one. Fresh fish. Don't go to sleep, boy. My dick going to taste so good in your mouth, boy. That is how Twitter sounds.
Fresh fish. People shouting fresh fish all day.
I'd rather see Twitter than hear it because you remember they introduced the young girl, the AI, into Twitter. And whatever she heard, when she came through the other side, she was like, I'm a whore Nazi. And I want to go to space. And I was like, oh, no, that's terrible.
Yeah, it's an awful place here. You're better off without seeing or hearing it.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, well, it's an option. Just take it off my phone, I guess.
You can get rid of
It's probably time for a question, isn't it, Dane, as is traditional with the format of the show?
Absolutely. I think it is definitely about time. As our esteemed guest, Mr. Herring, we invite you to ask a question to both myself and Howard, which we'd like to discuss for a brief period. And then this will be immediately followed by the hisser himself also asking a question, which we will discuss for about 15 minutes and some change. And then we lather, rinse and repeat. I'll ask the final question and we discuss, we learn more about yourself. And now that people are completely endeared to you based on our conversations, we find out where we can find you and where people can chase you and not have any red herrings, as with nominative determinism would necessarily determine. But no, we know where they can actually find you in a genuine way.
Okay.
And we all have a wonderful week with all of our sensory faculties. Fingers crossed.
Hope we get
fingers crossed. Yeah, in theory. Yeah. In theory.
We'll see how it goes.
So yes, as our esteemed guest, we welcome you to ask the first question, please.
All right. Well, I'll probably need some explanation. I probably need to explain this, but it's because it covers quite a lot. But I've been thinking about this a lot over the last couple of months. Is what drives the knee-jerk contrarians is the way I've put it, by which I mean. Well, I'm writing a book. I've just written a book about the thing I do on International Women's Day, where men come on Twitter and say, when's International Men's Day?
Yeah.
And weirdly, writing that over the last 2 or 3 months, the news has really impacted on the book because you realise that's not the only example of this. And I know...
Oh, of course, definitely.
I know, Dane, that you've been experiencing this. But obviously, the example I always use to show how ridiculous one's International Men's Day was as a question, because A, there is an International Men's Day, so it's even more ridiculous.
Exactly.
But is people, you know, when Black History Month comes up, people say, but when's White History Month? And you kind of think, well, if you understand why that's a stupid question, then you'll understand why the International, and you would, and I wrote it in the book, thought, don't even need to explain it. That is, people will say, and then, obviously,
how wrong you were.
Yeah. But it's interesting because it comes exactly out the same thought, right? So almost like asking when's International Men's Day is like the marijuana of this situation. And then you move on to the hard stuff once you've mastered that. And again, I thought it became all lives matter. And I thought, that's bad enough. And I didn't even think people would start then going, and then we'd get planes with White Lives Matter flying over football grounds and everything happening in America. So it's sort of, and also with COVID, is making people being asked to wear masks? Well, anti-vaxxers, but also being asked to wear masks because it will help other people, and then go, I'm not wearing a mask. How dare you impinge on my civil rights? You know, well, because it will help people. It's like wearing a seatbelt, or it's like, you know, I guess a seatbelt helps yourself, but it's the altruism. So it's just like people almost without thinking, if something's not directly about them, it has to be about them. And I'm trying, you know, this book is sort of partly trying to get to understand what that's about. Mm-hmm. But I'm really struggle to understand the mentality of that, where everything, I mean, I sort of understand it away because, you're like, I was a child and that's what children, and I've got children, that's what children are like. Mm-hmm. And I'm a comedian, so I'm quite self-obsessed. Mm-hmm. But
Howard.
Nodding, just nodding.
Howard.
You're nodding there.
But, you know, what makes you, you know, not have the nous to, I mean, the International Men's Day one's a funny one in some ways, though obviously not in other ways, but, you know, not even to bother, be so sure of yourself and yet so insecure in yourself that you don't bother checking, Googling it to check there is or isn't one, but also, you know, why would you do it? It's like being on a birthday. You know, I remember going to kids' birthdays when I was 4 or 5 and there'd be pass the parcel and then the birthday kid would win the pass the parcel and I'd go mental because why haven't I won? You know,
Is this supposed to be a fair game? It's a fair game. What, is Toby going to win everything today? Is he gonna his name's on the cake. What more does he need?
Is it just childishness? Because it's sort of a mixture of men are sort of, and it's mainly men, this. I don't think it's exclusively men, but it's mainly men. And they've got this mixture of supreme confidence. And in the book, I talk about that thing that was on Twitter a couple of years ago about when people were asked if they could take a point off Serena Williams at tennis, right? And about 25% of men either said they could or they didn't know if they could, right? You kind of go, you're so fucking deluded, right? If you're a national level men's player, you might get a point off Serena Williams, but people are thinking, oh, it's because, you know, she'll serve a double fault. She won't serve a double fault against you, mate. She won't have to.
No, she won't.
She'll be
100%. She'll give you the stop.
That's all you've got.
Yeah.
That's all you've got is the hope she serves a double fault. Is it really worth coming down for the game?
Yeah. But also, when you think about it, if it's a two-set match, it's so few points. You know, you might think, oh, well, a game of tennis is a long time. Not if someone wins every point it is. And a game of tennis is about 40 shots long.
It's part of the whole thing when guys go watching football and they go, I could have scored that. I'm sorry, you'd have had a coronary half a hectare way down the pitch.
So it's that weird confidence that makes men think they, you know, not even think, oh, maybe I couldn't beat, or, you know, and it's, I guess it's, there's sexism in that as well, maybe racism in that as well, but I think it might be sexism. We might have made a move on with Serena Williams, but it's only sexism. what a victory but in that instance. How can men be that confident and then that sensitive to be upset that somebody else is getting a day or a month or a, you know, or a little bit of attention from something, you know? So it's
what drives these contrarians? What drives them?
It's a really good question, and I think there's one short answer, but I definitely think it's for each one of those, like you said, there it refers to a particular different type of complex. So I think a large part of it is that when a lot of this. This complex has kind of gained a lot more strength recently with the social media.
Yeah.
And I think because of that, it's the short answer to the question is talk like that, and true democracy is the reason why we have aristocracy. So historically, like, people would have ideas, something, for example, like, you know, International Women's Day. And now with the democratization of the internet, then you have people who wouldn't normally be involved in this kind of discourse being like, well, why isn't there a men's day? Why don't women want to take out the garbage? You know, women never work who want to work in sanitation. And there was a time when if someone said that in public, we just go, shut up and keep taking out the trash. Why are you talking, you idiot? Shut up. But, you know, now people are very much enabled to have their, you know, which is why we even see the rise of the empowerment of the opinion, when people are like, I'm entitled to my opinion. Before, people would be like, I'm sure you are, but there's a reason why there's a door there and you don't have a key to enter that door, because your opinion doesn't fucking matter, because we're all scientists and you're a fucking idiot. So that's what normally needs to happen, is that A bunch of immune. So, for example, with COVID, you'd have an outbreak and you'd have immunologists and virologists working on that. And somebody outside might be like, oh, I don't like wearing a mask. And they'd go, well, that's why you don't work here, because you're a fucking idiot. And you don't know anything. That's why you're cleaning here, because you don't know about viruses. But the internet has enabled people to be able to be involved in this kind of discourse. And because of that, I guess it's just changed people's perspective, whereby by that same token, when they are introduced to like new or more progressive ideology, if it does reflect on them, especially in terms of, I guess, in terms of identity politics, because people will attach themselves to an identity. So, for example, if you take the complex of the cisgender male, when they hear about something like International Women's Day, even though it doesn't necessarily affect them directly, a lot of men, through aligning themselves with this identity, then feel threatened because they hear feminism, or they hear womanhood, and they hear, what they hear is misandry or chauvinism. So I guess based on their own experiences, they think, well, for women to be able to assert their own day where they are given this elevated status, then I lose my position and I lose my status. So they're like, well, why can't there be a men's day? And that's what happens when you, because I guess, like I said, through the democracy of the internet, everyone has a level playing field. And so no one really perceives themselves as having the comparative privilege they have in society. So if there's a, something that trends, for example, and appears to have enough interest and support on the internet, because it's truly democratic, the men who are existing on there feel like they're losing power and women are gaining power. So they become very intimidated and so they're like, well, why can't I be a men's day as well then? And I think a lot of time that's done because it makes it easier for people to deflect from sometimes their own guilt, because we're a social species. So people are aware that you know, women have been marginalized in society on a global scale. We live under the global patriarchy. Now, if you identify politically with the idea of patriarchy, you will feel very guilty about the way you are treating these women. But to offset that and to offset the responsibility of this political ideology, you're just like, well, there should be a men's day too. So it's, I think for the first part, it's a very good way of deflecting from taking responsibility in the context of identity politics, because a lot of people will identify with whiteness. And then if people are like, well, Black Lives Matter, well, it's like, well, they're saying that they must be talking about me as well. Well, all lives matter. And it's just this need, because people tend to align themselves with these ideologies, this need to try and defend their position, because they're like, well, I'm not a bad person. I never had slaves. And so people become very...
It's the whataboutism, right? That everyone kind of, that phrase has become so popular because it's just the quickest way. I mean, literally, Mr. Trump's only response is to say, yeah, but what about the other people? And I mean, the thing that I don't know if everyone was aware, and obviously our listeners should go and check out, Richard, like, you got an unbelievable... response, and you managed to, you know, what were some of the responses you got when your International Men's Day position?
I got flack from all directions with it, really. I mean, I think most people got it and appreciated it and got the joke, because the jokes rebounds on me, because what I'll do is try and find every single person who's asking the question on Twitter and then tell them that there is an International Men's Day and it's November the 19th. So actually, you know, in trying to, the idea is I want to stop it happening, but of course it never stops happening. It's like King Canute trying to stop the waves, you know, and ultimately the joke's on me, because by the end of the day, I'm going crazy, you know, shouting at people because no one's shutting up about this thing. So, you know, actually, you know, I was the troll, because I was going to find these people and then saying, yeah, here, but I was sort of usually politely just answering their question. So it was more that, and I understand some of it. I got both Meninists and some feminists didn't like it, because the Meninists didn't like it because they go, well, we should be celebrating International Men's Day, and you know, you're mocking it. And go, I'm telling people when it is, and I'm actually publicizing it.
Yeah.
And I support all the things that it supports. But actually, having looked into it more, which I probably haven't got time to talk about it, so you sort of realize all those things are done by Movember, which is a whole fucking month of for men,
right?
And
exactly,
it gets loads of publicity. Men go, well, it doesn't get the publicity. You go, Movember does, because people want to do it, because it's lighthearted and it's fun. And actually, though, what's interesting, I think, is the guys who ask the question aren't interested in International Men's Day. They don't come on into... last year, I emailed them all. I tweeted them all on International Men's Day saying, so what are you doing? You were worried about today. What are you doing today? And of course, none of them are doing anything on the actual day. They just want to complain. They're not interested in International Men's Day. But also Movember, which doesn't have this toxicity around it, which men and women can join in with, which is supporting men's mental health and suicide and depression and all those things that are very important that, you know, we do need to the problems that men do have, and it's all supported. It's a month long rather than a day long, and people get on board because it's fun and because it doesn't have this kind of toxicity around it. So weirdly, I think those guys are Well, A, they don't realize equality will benefit them, right? So they don't realize they are actually...
Or do they?
As much, well, they're as much of...
Because I think sometimes we try and give some people the benefit of doubt. So you're saying equality will benefit them, but really it's again, because of identity politics, there are some people who don't necessarily stand to benefit from equality the same way they do from privilege.
True, of course.
So I do get that, even though equality will benefit them, again, because of identity politics, because really, myself personally, I believe even now, even when we discuss something like Men's Day and Women's Day, in a very binary term, it's like, obviously, maybe we're discussing more elements of the masculine and the feminine, because both sexes display both characteristics in whatever varying degrees. But I say that to say this, because it's like, there are people that hold on to these more rigid ideas and more binary ideas, like being a man or being a white man or being a straight man. It's because I think for a lot of people, without those things, there's not really anything remarkable or distinctive about them. And so they have to hold on to it for two hands. And I think for some people, that contrarian thing is that every single time they find themselves within this nice Venn diagram of conformity, anything that challenges it or trends outside of those circles makes people feel very threatened. And I try to explain to people, like, you see the problem, the issue of white supremacy in America is that irrespective of your ethnic or racial background, you know, you're still living within a capitalist system which has a 1%. Now, for most people who will never be millionaires or may or may not realize their creative or personal aspirations, that can be a very difficult complex for most human beings to deal with existentially, especially when they get to a certain age, like a baby boomer. And I just think if you can give people the belief that despite their lives most likely turn out not to be particularly remarkable, that they are able to derive self-esteem from thinking they're better than everybody else, or at least 0.8 billion people on the planet, that is a psychological boom, which, you know, they can't buy from medication. You can't.
Well, because it all comes back to insecurities, right, Richard? That's the kind of thing, isn't it? The insecurities in these people drive them to do this.
I think it does, but I think, you know, I think you're right. A lot of that is brilliant in what you're saying. I mean, it's all brilliant, but there's a lot of truth in what you're saying. I think when you look at the guys who went to Parliament Square to protest about the statue being thrown in the harbour, they didn't know what, they had no focus. They didn't know what they were protesting against. They were just like lost. They were these lost guys, right? So I think for a proportion of the people who are complaining about International Women's Day, they're saying, well, men have it tough as well. Men have a hard time as well, which, of course, they do in some degree. But also men prop up the ideas of masculinity and the ideas of binary masculinity and the ideas of racial dichotomy and whatever as well. Mm-hmm. Men are the only people who try and conform to the stereotype we have, right? I think, and so they're trying to be as masculine as possible to the extent those guys are just fighting each other almost and pissing on monuments, you know.
That's always a part of the human journey whereby, if people do not have a very clear adversary in order for them to orientate their life, then they will tend to turn inwards, you know. So I just think it's as human beings, we just have this state of binary conflict, whether it's either, I guess, fight or flight. And I think this is how it applies to what we're dealing with, the phenomenon of, being contrarians. Especially, what you also have to take into account is the fact that this is us mainly existing on social media. And essentially, we're still quite adolescent in terms of how we deal with social media and how we respond to things. Because there are some people that if you're able to have, you know, normal structured discourse with them about the need for a Women's Day, they would understand it. But it's because we now live in a time where your phone can transform into a pitchfork or a torch with the click of your thumb. It's very easy for people to, like, basically just transform, because we all will entertain, as Howard said, it comes out insecurity. Everyone can get to those darker recesses of their mind whereby they can read a story that has of economic peril and think, well, if this happens or this happens, then I can't feed my kids. And already the seed of planted where you'd be adverse to, like, immigration, for example, because you're told it's a potential threat. Mm. So,
but it's so much to do with tradition, right, Dane? We've talked about this a few times on this show, that tradition and the feeling that you should stick to what you know, right, and follow those paths, somehow suggests that because you've been doing it for however long, that means it must be right.
We're just creatures of habit. So people are used to routines, and we'll disguise them as, like, social convention or culture, or we'll disguise them, like you said, as tradition. But it's just something that we get used to doing, and most human beings will have that normal inertia in the first place, even to the point whereby, like, in the Vietnam War, like, a lot of combatants only fired their guns after they were fired at them first, because they're not predisposed to conflict. So it takes a lot to make human beings move a lot of the time. So I was just saying about...
Well, I had a really weird one. I had a really weird one, I've got to tell you, because it's just bizarre to feel this way about something, which is obviously, you know, the baby, Dylan, has to wear clothes, right? Which I haven't bought any of them. My wife has organised that because she's very organised. Well done, Tara. She bought him a jumper, right? And it looked like a white jumper on the eBay. And then when it got here, it was pink, right? Now, is it... I can be honest, because everyone who listens to this podcast should know that I'm not a fucking horrible bastard, but hopefully. But, you know, like, I have to say, like, we talked about the fact he's wearing a pink jumper and why that somehow gets a reaction from us, as though it's something a bit off with that. And that's absolutely mental when you think about it.
And also, you know, the pink thing is only about not even 100 years old, the pink thing. I think Grayson Perry was talking about it. It kind of came up because some royal figure dressed a female child in pink, and then it became the fashion. So it's not something that goes back a long time in time. It's just become a tradition. And we're being really, you know, my son likes dressing up in all the dresses that my daughter has, and my, you know, and it could put it on and put it on makeup and doing all those things that I did as well. And you know,
it's conformity and routine. If you see something and everyone else is doing it, it looks fun, then why would you not want to do it? And your son will have no platitudes which relations to his expression of his sexuality or his gender. It's just, everyone else is doing it, it looks fun.
Yeah.
Why can't I do it? So I understand that. So, but like, as I was saying, Richard, because back to the whole social media thing about adolescent, I say that because...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I think people's minds are very adolescent when they are on social media. And if you think about your adolescence is a weird state for human beings to be in that you are not a child, but you have the mind of a child because you lack the wisdom and experience of living life. But at the same time, you have the faculties of an adult whereby you have a certain level of hormone secretion, or you might be going through puberty. But normally, because of this, the change in the hormones and stuff, your ability and your cognitive way of dealing with certain situations and coping mechanisms, they're changing and evolving as you're growing older, which is why on social media, like, it's like talking to a teenager, because you normally say to a teenager, are you going to wear a coat when you go out? I'm not a slut! How did we get here? What did you do? You know, that's what any parent would tell you. Like, and that's how people are on social media when you're like, you know, are you sure you want another cake? Don't shame me for being fat! I'm hungry! The parent's like, how did this happen? How did we get here? And I feel like that's a big part of it as well, because...
Yeah, no, it's very. That's
because I guess as you're becoming an adult and you learn to take more responsibility for yourself and have a more of an awareness of your own psychology and your own independence, then you tend to express that, albeit sometimes quite erroneously. So I think that's one of the reasons why you get this whole contrarian thing where you're like, you know, kids are starving in Africa, but there's kids starving everywhere. Why are you always? Because people, like I said, people take it on very personally because now they are learning. I guess people are learning to be witness to a lot more information than we used to have. Before, your newspaper, whether it's broadsheet or tabloid, was your only portal for news and geopolitics. Now you are bombarded from being ubiquitous where you can't escape it, and we are having to learn to adapt and, you know, be more in wise or pragmatic in how we invest our emotional currency. Because I think with most men who would be opposed, or men who you maybe describe as misogynistic, if you were to say to them, well, how would you like if I came to your house and slapped your mum and your sisters? They'd be like, of course not. So if you identify women, again, who they identify with politically, by the merit of either, you know, race or just being family, then they will defend those women. But this idea that this unseen force of, you know, female chauvinism exists in the internet. They can't see. That's like, then we will wear Dr. Martens and no women will shave their legs. They're like, why? Why are you doing this to me? So I think, yeah, it's just, I think a large part of
there's so many examples as well.
So many examples. Because in the same way that, like, you know, I put a somewhat provocative tweet about, like, I think it was a retrospective by Time when they were saying, how did Hitler get to power? And I was like, because people voted for him. And, you know, again, there is an element of humanity where, because now that it's humanity as it exists in the form of identity politics, is that people are like, so what, Dane? You're saying that white people are evil? I'm not saying that. I'm just saying those were the colour of the people living in Germany at the time. And I'm sure there were some black people there too, but legislation would dictate that even if they wanted to vote for Hitler, they couldn't. So, but then it's like, but people are like, oh, but you're just saying that white people are evil. I'm not saying that, but it's obviously that you have pondered this idea through the lens of identity politics, where if you've seen people from the same racial ethnic group as you committing atrocities, because you identify with that politically, now you are taking on all of that baggage as well. And that's what normally what happens, like I said, with teenagers, when you say something like, I don't know what's wrong with these kids. Why do you hate me, mum? I didn't ask to be born. I wasn't even talking to you, you know? I didn't even know where this comes from.
It's such a good point. I mean, it's such a good question. And we could talk about that question all day. I love it. I mean, straight pride is one of the things that I always love when people talk about. The idea that people are offended by gay people being proud to be gay, which, listen, I can imagine is a big moment in your life when you can say to the world and come out and say. Yeah. The idea that the response was, why is there... straight people look pretty fucking proud.
Exactly. And also, but when I think the issue is the fact that we describe these progressive movements as pride. Because even myself is like, I try to move away from the use of the word pride, because it's like deriving self-esteem or, you know, confidence or even positivity from something you had no control over.
Proud to be British.
Yeah.
Proud to be British. You didn't have a fucking choice, mate.
It's the vagina that you were in.
Nothing to do with you.
Yeah, the womb that you were in was on British soil, and that's why you're British. But people derive a lot of self-esteem from that. So I think it's... But what people don't understand is that obviously pride in terms of like groups like the LGBT plus community is that it's no, this is pride... in spite of the suggestion, structurally, that we are inferior. The same way as like black pride is not, I'm proud of being black, you shouldn't be proud of being white, is that despite the historic suggestion of my inferiority, I, through my human spirit, challenge this and say, no, I'm proud of who I am, you know, in spite of that. It's like, you know, so it's like, to try and explain it to like most attractors, it's like, you know the song, I Did It My Way by Frank Sinatra? That's what Black Lives Matter means. You know, we want to do it our way, all right?
I think it's due a rewrite.
Definitely. Oh yeah.
We're going to move on because we can talk about it today. But what a great question, Richard.
Absolutely. Great conversation as well. Thank you, guys. That's brilliant.
My question is gonna be a little bit of a trip down memory lane, actually, for some of our listeners and Dane and obviously Richard, which is to kind of reference a show that we mentioned in your biog earlier, which was for me and when I was growing up, the iconic This Morning with Richard, Not Judy, which for our listeners that may not know, because this is going to sound absolutely absurd to you that this ever existed, there was a show called This Morning with Richard and Judy on Channel 4?
ITV maybe, ITV,
the real one was on. So there was a genuine This Morning style show, and then on Sunday mornings, Richard and his comedy partner at the time, Stuart Lee, would host this show that looked a bit like that, but was nothing like that. It was a world of absolute absurdity that, as a, you know, me and my friends, we got VHSs of it when we recorded it off the telly because it was so good. And as Dane will remember, it was full of absolute madness. There was a man dressed as an orange. There was a guy who had a weak lemon drink, which was never fully explained what the lemon drink was. It was on at 10:45 in the morning. So my question to you, Richard, and to Dane, is absurdity in comedy does not seem to be the order of the day right now. And where is it? Where is absurdity in comedy? Because, it, you know, I think we all loved what Phoebe Waller-Bridge did with Fleabag. I think everyone can respect that work. And there's many other examples of comedy drama. But that absolute joyful silliness that you guys created on That Swing, where is that at the moment?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I think it is there. And I think actually maybe it's not on TV as much, but I think like on the internet, I'm doing stuff on Twitch at the moment, which is like a, usually a gamers platform, but quite a few people like Limmy's on there, and Limmy's someone who does absurd and wonderful and really inventive. I mean, he's just a genius, that guy. Like I don't know, you know, some comedians you can watch and go, right, I wouldn't do that or I couldn't do that, but I know how he did it and I know how his brain worked together or her brain worked together. But with Limmy, you know, he's on a different planet, and it's genius level. But there's a lot of people doing kind of weirder stuff on that. I'm doing kind of weird stuff on that again, I suppose. And I suppose within podcasts and within, you know, non-conventional, non-commercial sort of stuff, you can still mess around and play yourself at snooker. Or, you know, I'm doing a new podcast where I review the papers of the 128-year-old ventriloquist dummy, and I'm not great at ventriloquism, but I'm just learning on the job. And you know, that's where I think within the internet, we've got time, people can watch if they want to. Yeah. People don't have to watch it. And you can do something very niche on the internet. And because it goes all over the world, you could still get thousands of people watching it. But if you put it on BBC One, people would go, what the hell's going on, I suppose. So
well,
I think
on BBC Two at 10:45.
I think we slipped under the radar. I really wanted to do that time and nobody else did, and the BBC didn't care about that time. And actually it turned out to be great because it was Sunday and literally nobody who was important was watching it. So really, and the kind of people who would write in and complain weren't watching TV at that time either, either at church or not expecting stuff.
Absolutely.
So you
they're massively hungover.
Exactly. So as long as you didn't start saying fuck or whatever, you know, you could discuss. Although we sort of did swear secretly, but underneath while we were singing and stuff. But you know, you could get away with doing anything, and because we understood, I think with TV, there's basically, when you see with censorship, and we're seeing it with the blackface thing, right, where it becomes just, oh great, now I know what the thing is, so everything where anyone has anything on their face is now gone. And there's no distinction between going, oh hold on, in Community that guy's being an elf, that's not blackface, that's a guy being an elf, or you know what I mean. So if they've got a list of things, and it's usually words, but now it's also amazingly fucking late in the world. It's incredible that this was still going on in this millennium, but it was. But you know, that's now a thing on there. But as long as you didn't cross those lines, you could sort of do anything. And by discussing subjects you'd be much more like edgy and risky without swearing or without actually even being rude, just cover it, the stuff you're covering. So with that show, it was nuts. We were allowed to do it. We had freedom. We'd come out of radio, which again, I think in the 90s, we'd been on Radio 1 doing a sort of hosted show where we did sketches, where a lot of that stuff started, and they just let us get on with it. And I think that's the thing. And, you know, and obviously Vic Rees and Bob Mortimer did it and fantastically well, and still are doing that kind of surreal stuff fantastically well. I think the thing is that in TV terms, no one's left to get on with stuff, and they don't. What they do is if they do a sketch show, which they very rarely do now, or even a stand-up show, they put together a team. They don't find a group of people who've worked together for 5 years and have got a language and have got a way of looking at the world. So that what we had was 10 years basically with that group of people, where we developed a style of comedy and stupid, crazy ideas that you know, made sense if you'd followed the whole journey along, but then looked kind of wonderfully surreal if you hadn't followed the whole journey. But, you know, so it was, I think that stuff's out there, and I think people are doing it. And I think maybe to look on the internet, and I think maybe, you know, the one thing that's positive for comedy about the virus is that I think people are being forced to find new ways of doing stuff for a little bit. Yeah. And I'm hoping that out of that, I'm very much hoping stand-up will come back and survive.
It definitely feels to me that the absurdist, silly, however you want to define some of the themes of the comedy that you guys did then, you know, it does exist in the world, obviously. In America, I think it thrives phenomenally well.
Yeah, I mean, it's if you're given the breath to kind of pull it off, I think a lot of the time now, as Richard probably can see now, a lot more stakeholders are involved in comedy. Because I guess if you had something of that nature, like, you know, this morning with Richard, not Judy, that's something you're probably going to work at someone like Edinburgh, And then that would have had the time to develop and, you know, become a precipitator more closer to the idea you saw before. Whereas I think nowadays there's a lot more stakeholders involved, where that breath that you used to get to experiment and try things out in Edinburgh at the Fringe, for example, isn't, I don't think there's the same artistic license that you may have had historically, because now it's like you have to make money and be poised to be in a good position because it's so saturated to be like, you know, the people that the BBC pick to be developed. So, and then the BBC almost like, because it's so saturated, then they might give you only a little bit of time to develop something, and then you can't offend any kind of stakeholders or any kind of potential sponsors. And so then there's another cycle where they're going to find the next person, in the same way that like there was a time when an A&R would scout and source a good musical act and nurture and develop them for them to have a sound that's going to be able to cross them over a lot more. That was the way it would have been done historically. But I guess once, like I said, there's more commercial interest involved, like I said, they'll try and assemble people they think will look more popular and satisfy demographics, rather than picking a group of people with their own chemistry. So I think from that side of the industry, that's probably where you don't see the absurdity in comedy as much, because that organic development that's required to create something that is original and is a kind of absurd, there's not as many people that are willing to invest in it. So which is why you normally tend to find this a lot more on the internet or...
Yeah, and I think the big thing is, right, that you've got to be able, for that stuff to work, it's, I mean, comedy is always a risk, right? And telling a joke's always a risk. You don't know till you get it out there whether it's going to really work. You might think, I think this is going to work, but... You with that kind of stuff, you've got to try it, and you've got to try it, especially, you know, if you watch the first episode of The Sport of Rich Not Judy, the audience is sitting there going, what you know, like things that would later be things that would later be very popular, you know, play to silence because no one knows what's going on. And now some of those things that play to silence, we might have tried another time and it still played to silence, and we went, yeah, okay, let's not do that. So there's things that, you know, you take a chance and you've got to take that leap and, you know, and to go...
You guys took serious chances on that show. I remember, wasn't there an episode where you got trapped in a paradox for about 5 minutes?
I
often remember this sequence. It was incredible, Dane, because Richard had this board where he was pointing at the things, and then every time they kept trying to move on, he got trapped because he had to go back to a bit on the board, and it rolled for like, honestly, I remember watching as a kid, it went for the 5 minutes. And now, do you know what? I always think about it because Family Guy and Seth MacFarlane comedies love to do that thing where they drag the thing out for so long as they can.
Yeah.
You know, with a big joke or the fight with the chicken that never ends or all that stuff.
Yes.
So it's a very similar thing. But it is tough to see where those things breathe on British television at the moment. Whereas in America, you know, I don't know if you've seen I Think You Should Leave.
Yes,
the sketch show.
Yeah.
But if you haven't seen that, Richard, I can't recommend it enough, because that is an absolute quintessential stupid, absurdist comedy sketch show that I think we'd love a bit of that over here, wouldn't we? That's what British comedy was partly about originally, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, from The Goons and from Python, you know, but again, I think the key to it is all the things that you've seen and the young ones, all those things were just, someone said, all right, off you go, make the show and come back and show us the show. And we got that with This Morning, really. I think like the second series, halfway through, the executive producers came down to the studio that we were going to do something they didn't want us to do, right? So we had so much power, and they said, we'd write, you know, obviously it's live, you can do what you want. But if you do that, sketch, you know, I think it'll be very difficult for you to get another series, and we did it. But that was the level of power that they, you know, we had that power that they, so even when they came down, we didn't get another series, but we would not have got another series anyway. Mm-hmm. So that we kind of knew the writing was on the wall, so we thought, fuck it, let's do it anyway. But I can't even remember what it was, you know, it wasn't a massive major thing, but we were given so much freedom to get on with it, and nobody questioned us, and we were the authors of it and we were the creators of it. And, you know, the director and the producer might say, hey, what about this? But they wouldn't say, you can't do this, or I'm not really. And we, you know, so there was, you know, things that people can't believe were allowed out on daytime TV on a Sunday. But, you know, that, but I guess, you know, partly because people are more offended maybe, and partly because I think you're more right that it's to do. I think it just TV became more about the producers controlling it and less about the talent driving it.
Well, and it's really interesting because obviously, you know, Dane definitely has had some experience in this, as I know. But the thing about it as a producer, like, is you know, there's this kind of combination of elements that go into, you know, for our listeners who may not know how the industry works, but obviously, you know, there's people at the channels, commissioners or execs who decide, obviously, if they like an idea, and then it can move forward with, you know, financial backing on the basis of how much, you know, they like it. And then there's this process of collaboration that, you know, I can testify over 10 years of working in television can be fantastic at times. You might get a commissioner or, you know, someone at a channel who really sees what you're trying to do and really supports it and lets it grow. And then there's other times where you feel like we are all talking a different language and we are about to ruin the life of the talent, comedian, performers. You know, there's one reference I always give, and I had nothing to do with the show, which is if anyone ever saw We Are Klang live, they can tell you that's one of the best live groups that ever had in this country, and their show on television, they would all admit, did not translate. And that's, and I will blame the producers. I don't know who they are, but I'll blame the producers.
I mean, everyone can find it on IMDb, but...
I don't think they're commissioners anymore, which is why I'm saying. Okay, I don't think they're commissioners anymore, which is why I'm saying. Everyone remembers that group, right? Greg Davis and Marek Lahr. Those guys were something, and that show was not representative of that. And it had to be partly the fact that they weren't given enough of a rope to do their thing.
Funds and Games with Phil Ellis and the guys at North did. So Phil, along with Mick, and I think. Will Duggan was one of the other guys that ran it. So they had this show which won the panel prize, I believe, in 2014. Yeah, which was really, like, really funny variety show and stuff, which was for kids. So they'd run it as a kids show, but had loads of very adult jokes that were kind of put in subversively as well. And yeah, I think the BBC tried to remake it, but it ended up being kind of like a very kitsch quasi game show, which is what they were trying to parody in the first place. And I think that's another issue is that, as I said, it's because there's so much more stakeholders involved, because very clearly, Richard, it sounds like you guys were like, well, we're doing it for the art and this is a project we've never done before. We have no frame of reference. So we just want to have fun doing what we do on TV. And they're like, well, you might not get another series. And you're like, I have no idea how that works. What are you talking about? Richard, if you do this, you guys might not be syndicated. What does that even fucking mean? we're trying to get the consistency of lemon drink here. I don't know what you're talking about. So I think people, when you're a lot more green about the I guess the intricacies of industry, is that the art is always going to be a priority. I think now, because people are more savvy and more aware of how potentially lucrative or opportunities are available through
money, people are
a lot less inclined to like take kind of certain risks artistically. So I think you're absolutely right, Richard. I think it's still definitely there. I think you can definitely find it on the internet. And this is one of those things where I think once someone pushes that envelope and creates that space, then a lot more very similar acts will begin to appear. So there will never be that kind of centralized attention. So there'll be a lot more acts that appear. So I think it's definitely out there. It's just the medium by which we kind of discover it has probably changed. So I think people are still absurd. But also, Howard, you have to remember, in order for you to parody and make things absurd, they have to be more absurd than what's happening in real life. Let me take you through 2020. We begin with actual aliens being confirmed by the Pentagon. Then there were the killer hornets that bite off other bees' heads. Then you had a global pandemic. Then, you know, nigh on race war in America. Have I left out killer hornets? And then, right? So,
good point. Good argument. Yeah.
So when someone goes, hey, I got a really stupid idea, and then someone goes, the president has a Bible he's never read and grabs women by the pussy, you're like, oh, all right, I guess it's not that crazy after all.
Yeah, okay, I can see why comedy's gone quite serious then, really. It makes a bit more sense, really. But God, yeah, that's nice shell shock there, Dane. Thanks for that.
The truth is stranger than fiction nowadays. So.
Well, if you never saw that show, I think you should, listeners, go and find it. I'm sure you can find it because it was a real treat. And thanks for answering the question.
No, thank you.
I think about it a lot. There's people that me and Dane talk about all the time, like Mr. John Kearns, who one day we might get to come on the podcast. But John is one of the true classic absurd comedian brains.
Absolutely.
And I want him on my television. I want people like this on my TV. You know, it seems weird.
So make it happen. You have the power now, Howard, as a producer. We just have to
work
to create the world we want to see.
So it's over to you, Dane, for the final question of today's episode.
Indeed. Now, I'm going to throw a curveball because I had an original question, which again pertained to your body of work, Richard, because I was kind of going to ask a question about like Fist of Fun and how you think people would respond to that today, because I guess we always discuss this new, I guess, sensitivity amongst comedy audiences. But I feel like we answered that question in the previous one. So while we're all here, I wanted to ask you guys. So up until yesterday, I was a Virgo. But according to NASA, now I'm a Leo. Now,
can you explain this for our listeners? Because they might not all know what's going on.
To give people background, according to NASA, they are based on the correct time and division of the days required for the Earth to orbit around the sun. Historically, the zodiac sign has been broken up into the 12 signs of the zodiac. But based on recent data, there are actually 13 signs within the zodiac. So it's no longer the usual suspects. Apparently, now there's one called, let me just find the name, Ophiuchus. Ophiuchus, spelled O for Oscar, P for Papa, H for Hotel, I for India, U for Uniform, C for Charlie, H for Hotel, U for Uniform, and S for Sierra. And the dates of Ophiuchus are November 29th to December the 17th, which means if you used to be a Sagittarius or a Scorpio, you aren't anymore. Now you are neither horse nor scorpion. You are, I'm assuming, some kind of spice for gin-based cocktails. So my question is, based on our previous conversations about being a contrarian, are you guys up for changing your star signs? Because I'm not. I'm not.
I Richard, think do I you move... care? Do you care about them? Do you care
I
about
don't
star
care
signs,
about them. I'm Cancer currently, which is, you know, not a great...
it's not the best name. It's not the best name. No. It's not the best name.
No, I think I become Gemini, I think, if under the new system. So that's a bit better. But I don't, you know, yeah, it's one of those things, isn't it, of... Well, it's the way we divide up humanity. I mean, it sort of shows how stupid all the divisions are. You know, like every time we try to lump ourselves together by whatever means, by sex, by race, by the day we're born, and then you're in your little tribe, you're in your little gang, but it's all fairly meaningless. I think with astrology, it's all meaningless, whereas at least there's some argument with the others that there's some connecting factors. But just being born... Yeah, these things are created like 3,000 years ago based on the stars then, and people, the idea of, again, it's about human beings, it's that mixture of arrogance and sensitivity, isn't it? Because you sort of think, the big stars up there, that must influence my life. those big
always,
bright lights.
It's always easier to give
me something to do with me.
Giving over power and you know, giving over your responsibility to, you know, factors and both invariable and variable that you can't control is much easier than taking responsibility for your own actions. For example, I'm a Virgo, which means the maiden or the virgin. And I feel like that's why I didn't have sex until I was 18, Richard. I was like, you know, if I wasn't a Virgo, I would be waist deep in love. But because I'm a virgin by nature, the stars have dictated that I gotta wait a little longer than everybody else. You know,
I'm a Sagittarius, so I had a real confidence boost. I think I'm a late Sagittarius. And does that mean I'm not a Sagittarius?
Well, if you ask Richard, you're nothing, Howard. Why don't you grow up? but apparently, are you a Sagittarius? Well, unless your birthday falls within December the 17th and the 20th of January, you are actually an Ophiuchus, and I still don't know what that is. And also, it's easily now the most pretentious of all the star signs. Who is spelling that, buddy? Like,
everyone in Shoreditch is going to want that one.
Everyone in Shoreditch will want that one, but how bad do people feel now? There must be socially distant queues outside of tattoo parlors all over the Mediterranean now. Are people going, well, when I came in, I thought I was a Gemini. Apparently, I'm an Aries. And then someone's like, typical Aries shit, can't decide. Fuck you, you were just a Gemini yesterday. You don't know who you are.
Do you find it hard not to belittle people who follow this stuff? Because
I think in the modern world, right, what I think about this stuff, and I was talking to the historian Bettany Hughes on my podcast yesterday, and she's interested in ancient Greece and all this sort of stuff. And in her book, which is about Venus and Aphrodite, it's very interesting, and the way that a god changes over time kind of informs you about the society and the changes in society and the balance of the sexes and all that sort of stuff. But 3,000 years ago, you were unlikely to get beyond 30. You could get ill. You could, you know, it was confusing. It wasn't like believing in God or believing outside forces was a choice. You know, that was the only way to get. She sort of said, you know, if you said, is there a God? It'd be the same as saying, is there a sea? You know, is there a sea there? That people wouldn't be able to comprehend it because they, you know, they had to live their life by those forces. That was the only way through this kind of jungle of, you know, all these terrible things that were coming at them from every direction.
Rationalizing is a really good point because it's like you said, it's that's like, it's humanity, you know, it's a trip and it's the longest experience we'll have. So you're right. Thinking God's existence stuff, it makes it a lot easier for you to be like, how did that big ball of light disappear? And there's a smaller one and now there's a bigger one again. For someone to try to explain that to you, it's much easier to be like, there is a magical man on a magical golden chariot that rides through the sky and drinks it to hell. And in a battle, it returns. That is more, at that point, when you don't have any frame of reference, is much more plausible than someone being like, well, a giant ball of gas is so tightly. Oh, that sounds kind of plausible. How far away? 993 million miles away from Earth. So, if someone said that to you in a pub, 193 million miles from Earth, you'd say it is time for Gracchus to be executed. Did you hear what he just said over a glass of mead? He's lost it. So,
yeah. So, you know, you don't understand how anything works, and but your whole life depends on, you know, the crops growing or stuff being there, or, you know, and you're right, trying to explain away your behavior. So I think a lot of Aphrodite is interesting because, you know, it's about love and it's also about war a little bit, but those the feelings of passion and sex, and if you're with someone else and fancy someone else, it's kind of convenient to go, yeah, oh, Aphrodite came down and cast a spell, and that's why I fucked my next door neighbor, so it's not my fault.
Exactly.
So, you know, and in a way, it's sort of, you know, life feels like that sometimes, doesn't it? Life feels sometimes like you look back at something you did and think, why the hell did I do what did exactly. I take that risk for? Why did I do that? And it's as if someone else is controlling everything. So it's, you know, it's completely understandable. You know, if people want to believe in it, it's not, there's no like harm in it. In fact, you know, there's no one fighting over astrology. There's no one saying, you know, Virgo lives matter.
It could happen though. It could happen. Only if people feel like they're threatened, but I loved it.
Oh my God. There's going to be a whole movement against this new star sign.
Definitely.
There?
And I feel like
back in my day when a Virgo was a Virgo.
Yeah, exactly. Scorpios in my day, do you know what I mean? Had a sting in the tail. Now they just behave like statues these days. Who knows? You know what? But based on that, Richard, I'd love the idea of perhaps like it would be, that would be the best talking head show, would be to resurrect people from these periods whereby this was the most plausible explanation for some of the like more natural phenomenon they saw, and like have a guy sit there and be like, what happened to your wife? Well, I believe my wife was a bride of Satan, so we put hope pokers in her so we'd know if she could take the devil or not. And then have explained to him and see his face be like, oh fuck, what? how could that make sense?
You know what, I'm gonna have to bring this back to a subject I've been looking forward to discussing on the podcast, and I'm aware, Dylan, my son, one day you may hear this, so apologies. However, I am a Jewish man. I was brought up in a pretty Jewish household, not very religious, but culturally Jewish. So you know where this is going. I'm missing a bit. And it's never affected me in a particularly negative or positive way because I have nothing to compare it to. However, when the subject of this was broached with my wife, who is a pretty non-religious person, she said to me, what the fuck are you talking about? Why would I cut a piece off our son? To which, when I thought about it, I was like, well, because then it'll look like mine, which was my only answer. But it obviously is absolute madness to do that, in my opinion, and we haven't done it. So he's all intact as we speak. But you kind of look at that and you think, God, we were about to do that on the basis of what? Tradition? Like what? Like that is...
I imagine it was a time when, you know, that may have been a more hygienic practice. And I feel
that
a lot...
I get that, but... Definitely not now, right? Definitely not now. It doesn't make any difference.
So many, I think that's what I mean. That's so many things come down from a long time ago when they did make sense, and some of them continue to make sense, and some of them don't.
Exactly, and it's always the mind, the zeitgeist at the time. Like for example, for myself personally, when I hear about the phenomena of suicide bombing, if you imagine like, you know, a particular part of the world which is very sexually repressive, and you know, men themselves don't even get to even reflectively explore sexuality and get a reference for the female form. If someone comes up to you and says, if you do this, there's going to be 72 virgins in heaven, that doesn't sound that crazy to me. To me, if I've grown up in a society where I've barely even been able to observe the female form, and then someone says 72 types of untapped pussy in heaven, I'm going to be like, who am I going to kill? Who am I? Like, to us, the idea is asinine, but if you take into account, you know, years of transgenerational sexual repression, where you've got a bunch of men that are full of testosterone who don't live past the age of 35, and then you are like, if you sacrifice yourself in the name of God, you got 72 virgins that no one else has seen before. That sounds kind of plausible. But
there's logic to that. Whereas the foreskin, thing, on you know, applying the same criteria, you're literally like, dear God, thank you for my son. As a tribute to you, here is us removing his foreskin really awkwardly, really painfully, and now he is a devout follower. I mean, what? That's just nonsense, right?
It seems to be a criticism of God as well. It's like saying, you got it nearly right, mate, but then we're going to just take that bit of wrapping off you and chuck
also,
that
away. Also, Richard, following your point, the spectacle of men queuing on Judgment Day in heaven, and everyone's like, you there have lived a very, very devout, good Jewish life, and you have followed the Torah to the letter. Just one more thing. Let me see your dick. Oh! No. I'm so sorry. No paradise for you. Come on, man.
It's like a checklist, right? Bacon, foreskin, no. Sure, well, come on in. You know, you're welcome.
Listen,
it's like, it doesn't make any
sense. If it's pink and crispy and salty, not this religion, buddy, is the worst campaign ever.
But every belief system, any culture will have something not necessarily exactly like that, but like that, which everyone accepts. And again, that's what we does take us back to the beginning. You know, someone challenges it, and you go, no, what? Because also once you've done something for so long, to challenge it seems even more
exactly
like, offensive, doesn't it? You go, well, no, but we've been doing it for so long that you're saying that not only I, but every one of my ancestors wrong as well.
Through identity politics, people attach the ideals. So for you to come along and challenge that now, like it's like, so everyone's kind of cold penis for no reason. It's very hard for people to kind of rationalize. But yeah, I definitely think this.
Can I just tell you that one solution to this problem would be International Foreskin Day.
I bet there is one.
And there absolutely there is International Foreskin Awareness Week in May.
There you go.
Well, there probably should be, because then at least then, because then some men would be like, well, how come women don't get to get this calf? And then we'd be like, it does happen. It's FJM and it's not normally elective. Thanks for bringing it up. Let's raise awareness. And now we've caught them in their own paradox.
Well, you know, it's not. I mean, I wrote a whole book about this, and Tom Rosenthal's about cocks, and that was one of my shows, Talking Cock. And Tom Rosenthal did a very well acclaimed show about your exact issue as a Jewish guy and having had something removed from him. I mean, I felt. It's one of those, but the person involved doesn't get the choice in it, and that's what's weird.
That is
very
weird.
It doesn't. You know, sometimes it happens for medical reasons. Sometimes it happens for whatever.
Different scenario. Different scenario.
You don't absolutely need to have a foreskin, but also there's any surgery taken holds risks. You know, so people die and people get castrated and stuff accidentally during this. So it's a very, you know,
you've had a baby, Richard. How protected? You're like trying to like not injure it every day, right?
Yeah.
So you're like, oh, the way I put his head down on his little blanket, oh, I think he just banged his head a little bit. Oh, I just want to be a bit more careful. Yeah, but don't worry about when I'm going to cut a fucking bit of his body off. Like, what the fuck?
My cousin had a circumcision because, this is a very common practice for hygienic reasons amongst my community as well. And I think I was up next, but my cousin and I are anemic. And so we don't have, at the time, we didn't have some of the clotting factors required to stop bleeding. So suffice to say, didn't turn out well for him, and for a long time, many hours for him to change his underwear.
Oh, man.
And so I was like, no way. No, he's fine now, but that was enough for me to be like, nope, I am happy to have I'll have a TED talk with whichever God is the true one, because there is no way. And like you said, Howard, it's like, you know, when you are protective of someone you care about, you love, and they're like, first I'm going to smack their bottom so they cry, and you're like, okay, that sounds about right. Now I'm going to put a scalpel to their genitals. What's going on here? Is this not medicine? What year is this?
I'm glad we've got to the bottom of that. It's been a very entertaining episode, Richard. I must say,
okay, no, it's been lots of fun. You're very clever young guy. Ah,
thank you so much.
Very impressed with you.
We're doing our best. Just very trying to carry the torch. And again, can't thank you enough, Richard Herring. Me and my friends who were in my German A level could not stop going about Fist of Fun. So this is a true honour. So thank you very much.
That's very nice.
For people that aren't as enlightened as myself and Howard about your work, where can we find out more of your stuff and check out your current project?
Yeah. My podcast, Rahlstp, it's got RHLSTP, is on all your podcast apps and YouTube. I'm doing Twitch stuff most nights of the week at the moment at twitch.tv/RK Herring. And my book, which discusses a lot of the stuff we've been talking about, is called The Problem with Men, When's International Men's Day and Why It Matters, which I think is available for pre-order now. So if you go to Amazon, Waterstones, or wherever you get your books, and if you could pre-order it, it's going to be on audiobook, it's going to be on Kindle and ebook, and it's going to be a book. So
very exciting.
Pre-orders matter a lot, apparently. So I'd
we
love
will
it
be sharing that on our social media feed, guys.
Oh, thank you.
You to go and get it, because I'm sure it's going to be a great read.
It's I've really enjoyed doing it. It's been really, and it's been very interesting. And I just thought to begin with, it'll be a funny book, and it is a funny book. But I think it went in some unexpected directions for me, partly because of the world going in unexpected directions. But also, the more you think about it, the more the deeper you get into it. As we've seen, the more there is to say about it. So it's an interesting subject.
It's good, good. And I can't, to the listeners here, I can't recommend Richard's podcast enough. I was able to be an esteemed guest. Loads and loads of fun. And hopefully once we are off of lockdown, please do go to Leicester Square Theatre and check out a live recording, because it is very fun, very immersive. And I know, what about other podcasts? Fuck them. Just go to the damn show.
Thank you again,
Richard. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Have a wonderful one.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTiste. Our guest was Richard Herring. You can follow Richard on Twitter at Herring1967 or on Instagram at RKHerring1967 or on Twitch at RKHerring. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at TheHowardCohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Decode. You can follow D on Twitter and Instagram at OfficialDecode. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQEPodcast. Thanks to Polly, Gelly and the Acast team for all their support. Thanks for listening, guys, and remember, question everything.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.